afternoon. So last time, and interesting. Is this mic? Okay. The mic is now not hot. Okay. So last time we talked a bit about sort of using signatures to match malware. Our idea is that we have sort of identified malware in the past and we want to quickly and efficiently find that again in the future. We have this idea of using these regular expressions, these patterns where we have simple operations like choosing between a bunch of alternatives and having repeats of something. And we can make signatures that look in this way, and this would allow relatively efficient matching. We saw that there's this strategy that you'll probably learn more about in DMT2, where you can make a state machine where we basically keep track of a state, you know, where we are in the matching patterns, and we have a table to look at one byte, figure out where to advance. And this is at least sort of a very conceptually simple matcher we can make as far as execution, like producing it from the patterns, not trivial, but actually executing it is pretty trivial. We have this kind of byte by byte matching. And we mentioned that sometimes that's not fast enough, especially when we have tons of patterns. Those tables get huge. We have a huge number of states, so we can make it faster even more by looking for kind of anchor strings. Since some of the patterns are probably going to be a constant, we can search for those constants. We can have a hash table to efficiently store something to check for those constants and avoid checking most of the file. We can also use heuristics like, you know, maybe some parts of the file are less likely to have malware code in them and we don't need to check them very carefully. And, you know, kind of what we were thinking about when making these signatures was sort of how distinctive are they? Do they actually identify our malware? And how likely are they to like be defeated by the malware author just doing something simple or maybe even by accident, because we know there's variants of malware. And then we talked about kind of a separate technique that's complementary to our signature-based detection of looking at behavior. So rather than having our signatures be based on looking at the actual machine code, we can say, let's look at what does the program do when it runs. And we can do this either kind of for all the programs we're running, we can kind of look at their behavior, and instead of matching, you know, bytes in their file, we can match they open this file, then open this file, that's bad. Or if we don't want to do it while they're running normally, we can run them in a virtual machine or an emulator and do the same idea, that we're running them in this restricted environment, but we can record what they do and say, this is their behavior. Does that match a pattern that we've listed as this is not good? And the behavior-based detection idea has the advantage that, well, some of the things we might detect are things that kind of the malware can't avoid doing. Whereas with the machine code, probably they can avoid having specific bytes in their machine code if they think hard enough about it. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so last week I promised I would go over my solution for like how I hope people would have solved the RE2 part B. So let me find my notes for this. Here we are. Okay, so here I've opened up that program in the in Dihedra, and I want to first, you know, find the interesting string. So I go to define strings, and I can search for your task, and I find the string is here. I make this window a little bigger, and I say, oh, this is referenced here, which is this function. So I'm going to call this function something like that output string, so I can find it later easily. And this function is called from here. So I'm going to call this function, which over here, I can just go to the decompiled view, scroll up, and I'm going to call this function that calls function output string. Maybe I choose a less verbose name. And if I go back here to where I was, we can see that there's this global variable that controls the string. So we'll call this kind of the interesting global. And there was a hint in the assignment that it sure would be useful to know how some of these functions are called. So we have this function that uses this interesting global. And we'll do a little more investigation first of this interesting global. So if I look at this interesting global in the listing view and make it wide enough, I can see it's referenced a bunch in the function that calls the string and elsewhere. In fact, I can do pull up show references to interesting global, and I can see, oh, here are where it's referenced. So we can see it's set to 2, so ordered with 2 in this function, some sort of switch statement. So this is another interesting function. So function that, so we'll name that, and then we have in here we have, you know, our use of that, and we had our or with 1, 2, and we have a write here. Yeah, since it's a 0, we have a read and we have a write here. So this is showing us stuff in the assembly view. So here's the assembly view. I'll go back. There's a back button. And we can see that this code, eventually the compiler realizes it's equivalent to what the compiler shown here. Or I could have control left in the decompiled view for interesting global. So you can see that there's this variable here, which has to be 76 at some point, and also our second parameter of this function. So it would be useful to know what the parameters to our two interesting functions are. So we have this function that calls the function that outputs the string. So I know that this is at address 4E1520. So what I can do is I can run run this here and set a breakpoint at that address I recorded earlier. Just run and see what happens. You know, run some command and then we stop there. And I know that the first argument to the function is going to be an RDI, then RSI. And it's a long pointer and a care pointer. Care pointer seems very interesting, so let's print out the care pointer. Oh, well, that's useful to know that this function gets passed my input. And I can do the same thing for the other function, which is at 444500, the other function, and the one that ORs with 2. So I can continue, and we stop in that other function we see. And I can see that other function, I can go to function with ORs with 2. Its parameter, first parameter is a byte array. That might be interesting as a string, so that's RSI. I can see that's empty, okay. That's, is that, oh, sorry, RSI is the second parameter, RDI, so, and we're back in RDI, so it's being passed one semicolon, then we continue, and it's being passed semicolon, so we can guess what this function is doing. It's getting parts of our input. And if I had properly printed out the first argument and not the second the first time, we would see it had the select one. So that tells me kind of what that first, that string parameter of these functions are. So then we get to, okay, so how can we figure out how to get our actual useful code to run? So we have our function that calls function to output string. And one thing we want to happen is we want this to be 3, which means we have to be set to 1 and ORed with 2, because those were our only things we could saw we could do. So let's look at first our find error. It is control F. Interesting global. So previous. So is up here. So we have our setting of interesting global up here. So we have this thing that must be 76. And then we know param 2, which is the string we pass in. Which is the string we pass in, it looks like, needs to have a z at position 1 and an underscore at position 3. And I think something people missed is that, oh, well, this param 2, this param 2 is changed by the function. And we should look for that. And one way we can tell that is that we know a function that ORs with 2 is called different things. The other way we can tell is that there's the bunch of code here with param 2 that manipulates it. And it's incrementing it. We can see it's going through the string. So we know wherever we've advanced to in param 2 in this loop needs to be that way. And then we need to figure out how do we get this value to be 76? Well, if we look at the function that ORs with 2, we find out it's passed as a parameter, and if we look in this code, it's set like here, but not to 76, so there's no setting it to 76, except it's passed to this function. So let's see how this function here, the function that ORs with 2, manipulates its second parameter. And I'll just search for 0x76, since that's what we want it to be. And we can find, oh, there's this code here that sets something to 0x76. That's not what we want. What is this? Is that what we want? So I of error 10 gets to that, and then we go here, down here, oh, then we assign I of error 10 to param 2. So this is our code path that sets it to 0x76. And it's looking for something equaling b of error 5, and it's, or in this case, 8. And we also have this check that bver 5, which is the second bver 5, okay, which, well, what is bver 5? So let's look up before the switch statement. Bver 5 is the first character of our input. So I'll just rename that, first char of func input. And we have our, the first char of func input needs to not be this, and it's a character, so I'll just make it display as a character. And so you could say, huh, well, for that to happen, the first character has to be a semicolon, a single quote. So then we can tell we need a single quoted string with that, those things in that position to trigger the for one condition. For the other condition, we have our call to that set, we have our setting of interesting global, and it's based on param 1 is going to be part of our input, and we can see that that's a star. But what's the first character? Well, we had to get to this case here, so we should look at the switch statement. And the switch statement is taking the first char of our input and looking it up in some sort of array. So I will first indicate that this is an array. So we have a byte array. And it needs to be OXF when we look up in there. So I will look at my byte array here, and I scan for OXF, and I find out it's an index 3333, which corresponds to an exclamation point in ASCII. So questions on my general sort of what I was hoping people would do. So I think a thing people missed is like tracing backwards for uses of a variable. There's this big switch statement. Like, you should try to figure it out, probably. You know, because, you know, this condition, yeah, it's not trivial, but it's not, but it's very useful to figure out. But that's sort of what I was hoping people would do. And notice that I skipped over a few steps, but for the most part, like, I wasn't reading most of the code. I was looking for the stuff that's relevant. So I see param 1 and param 2 use. I just look for, are they modified? That's what I care about. If they aren't modified, the code's irrelevant to me for figuring out what happens here. And the same thing for, like, that local thing being 0x76, you know, I say, well, that's the interesting value. It's setting it to something else, probably not useful. Don't need to look at it. The other thing that wasn't what I actually expected people to do, but turned out to be a useful way to solve this, is that for some of these functions, so the function that calls the function that outputs the string, another thing you could do is you could say, there's this constant here, and you have the source code. You could search the source code for that constant and find where this function was. And given that, you could then go through the original source code and just relabel all the variables to match the actual source code. Then you have the comments in the actual source code. And maybe, and a lot of people found that easier to figure out. And that's something you should probably think about in general when you know you have reference code, is that you can look for distinct things like strings, like this pointer to something is not an error. Yeah. These strings may be a little less useful, but like this string, pretty easy to find, and only appears in this function in the source code. Okay, so questions about my process for that? So let's get back to talking about sort of where we're talking about monitoring behavior. So we mentioned that, like, in addition to, we talked about you could do this with OS support. You can do this in some less ideal mechanisms, like changing how, replacing libraries in effect, or, you know, replacing the OS exception handlers. So another thing people kind of would like to talk about is, you know, has been a popular proposal for by vendors of anti-malware software for doing malware detection, is doing some machine learning. And I would encourage you to be skeptical of this. So if we look at, like, not very recent academic research on this, like, but a common idea is, oh, we have these big data sets of malware. If you're an anti-malware vendor, you probably have that. Let's just look at kind of all the features we can collect from that and use some sort of machine learning algorithm that does classification to classify malware, you know, and do this kind of automatically with the idea that, you know, this way we don't have to manually write signatures all the time. And I think this can be a kind of useful idea, but I'm generally skeptical of it. And a big reason I'm skeptical is that this is a hard, that you're not usually evaluating this in the right context. So this paper, they had a big database of applications, you know, they got pretty good results, you know, competitive with commercial stuff where they probably were specifically tuned. But the problem I would encourage you to think about if you're thinking of this style of approach, and this probably also includes things where you say, let's use an LLM to do things, is what are attackers going to do in response? And the big issue is that most sort of techniques that are doing these kind of statistical matching sort of things are not really designed to deal with adversaries. You have to do extra work to think about how do you make them deal with adversaries. So one thing you might do is if you know someone's doing this sort of pattern matching, training a classifier, often the way those classifiers work is there will be some factors that make programs be more likely to be marked as benign. And because this is not being done by a human who's thinking about, is this factor really an indicator of benign software, this is something you could deliberately add to your malware. And the other thing is that as a malware author, you have the opportunity to deliberately mistrain these systems because you provide malware samples. So you can deliberately make your malware samples, you know, I have something weird that this detection technique will find and then stop doing the weird thing. You know, and this would probably, you know, not work so well in a human, but you know, they aren't, this is most machine learning models don't have adversarial thinking in them. They aren't trying to do this. So, speaking of sort of adversarial approach, our next big topic is going to be what we might call anti-antivirus. So, thinking of things that malware authors are going to do in response to people who are trying to do anti-malware stuff. So this includes kind of making the analysis harder, so making it harder for you to produce signatures, harder for you to figure out what the malware does, harder for you to write a program that therefore repairs it, and harder to automate analysis, and also to make viruses and other malware which evade signature-based detection by just not having a fixed signature. And some terms you'll see that I'm not going to test you on because they're, you know, but I want to mention them because you'll probably come across them in various literature and elsewhere. So sometimes people refer to malware that tries to make analysis harder as armored, and malware that changes its code as it's copied will be referred to by as metamorphic or polymorphic or oligomorphic, and generally these terms are referring to different amounts of code changing. We'll talk about specifically what each one is later. But there was kind of an evolution where malware went from this, you know, did this something that they called oligomorphic first, and then they did a better job at hiding from signatures with something called being polymorphic, and then an even better job with something that analysts call being metamorphic. So to start talking about this, we'll talk about kind of generic anti-analysis techniques. So one thing is sort of what's called code obfuscation. So there's obscuring the code. And there's a bunch of techniques for this, and this has overlap with stuff that's used kind of more outside of the malware domain commercially for people who distribute commercial software and have some idea that people reverse engineering their software would be bad for them. They will try to make the software be restructured to avoid reverse engineering. And what do I mean by kind of restructured? Well, to give some concrete examples of that, I'll give some examples of something, a tool called Tigris that you can look up, and you can see they have some other transformations they do. And basically, what Tigris does is it takes a C program and converts it to another C program that is structured in a different way, such that when you compile it, it's going to be way more annoying to analyze, you know, and often targeting the sorts of things we might do in a program like Cathedra. And we'll have some future assignments which will involve some code with Tigris and some code that uses a technique we'll discuss later on called packers. So to give an example of some Tigris transformations, I'm going to show you the pattern. Tigris, because it actually works on the abstract syntax tree from a C compiler, its code looks way worse than what I'm showing you. So I'm showing you the clean version so you can understand what is the transformation being done And we can think about why is that something people are doing to avoid analysis. So one thing that came up in RE2 is that it turned out to be really convenient to look for strings to find functions. So something transformation that Tigris does is it says, well, we shouldn't have any strings in our code. So they just get rid of all the constant strings, they make this function that produces them with like straight line code, and you call that function when you need it. So this makes analysis more annoying. Like, is this actually like really hiding the information? No. Once you figure out what this function does, you can label all the places where it's called and, you know, figure out what the strings are. It's going to take you time, but this is, I think, indicative of most obfuscation techniques, is that they aren't like really fixing a problem, and you could kind of roughly automate, you know, basically making those irrelevant, but that's a lot of what people are doing in trying to hide things in code. And to give a more concrete example, this one, where did I put a window? Oh, here we are. Okay, so to give a more concrete example, I have a version of fish from RE1 that I've done that transformation on. And we can see here's a function that outputs something, and it calls our getString function, which I've helpfully labeled. And if we look at the getString function in Dihedra, like this is how it decompiles. Like, so, annoyance, like Dihedra's not up, but it's not, like, but you can see why they're doing it. Like, this is taking probably some of our easiest analyses and making them more difficult. So another sort of set of transformations that are interesting in Tigris is that it has transformations designed to obscure flow control. So a lot of what we end up doing when we're looking at programs, especially with nice decompilers, is we say, okay, well, they're going to give us the structure of the function. We can look at that. And even without the decompiler, we have a nice assembly view with the graph. So something you might try to do is you try to get rid of that sort of structure. And one place to do that is with functions. So we have this transformation where we just say, we're going to combine all the functions together into one big function. So this means that when you look for things are called, it's not super useful. Can you undo this? Yeah. So I have here. So to give example of that, so here's the fish program where all the functions but main have been merged into one function. So we have this one function with a huge number of parameters, and it has this switch statement on the last parameter, which is basically the code for each one of the functions. And sometimes the parameters are ignored, and you can see it calls itself a bunch of times because it's calling a function. So again, simplifying, like we could undo this transformation once we figure out what's going on. Like it's not a real defense measure, but it is going to take time. And there's also the opposite of that transformation, which is splitting the function into multiple functions to make the presence of function calls less useful. And you combine these steps together. So a lot of what we're doing here is making our interfunction flow control, which is usually a big thing we look at in analysis, kind of obscuring that. But we haven't obscured the in-function flow control much, but that is another sort of transformation. So here, another big transformation is what Tigris calls flatten. So what we've done here is we've said that instead of having this if-else structure, we're going to re-represent that as a loop where we label this as 0, this as 1, this is 2, this is 3, and we have a s variable that tells us which one to go to next, and we just have a loop. We set that variable appropriately, and we have this loop with a switch statement. And there's kind of more sophisticated versions of this where a lot of what we're doing here is we're moving flow control to data changes, which, you know, often messes up kind of automated analyses that are trying to present stuff to humans. Some questions about any of these transformations? I'm lingering on this slide since this is the one I recall people having the most trouble understanding. So these are all transformations that, you know, are annoying for analysis, and they're generally not things that self-spreading malware will do, because these sort of transformation is like really wants you to be working with something higher level. Yeah, you could do it with assembly, but it's probably you need something more like C code to do this transformation. So we're going to end up talking about some transformations that malware does, self-spreading malware did, and that stuff obviously needs to work on machine code. So they're generally not using these sort of higher level ideas. So we looked at some examples of these sort of classical obfuscation. Let's see which of these things is likely to be most or least likely to be hampered by doing the types of obfuscations I showed you. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what should be easier or harder.
Different forms of their trips.
Well, wait, where is this?
I'm assuming like we have, if we are assuming like whether we have the patch already, or you'll say you like what you need, and we have the patchwork, yeah, then I feel like C should be easy if we have it.
Well,
yeah, but then if we had to go through the first deuce. Okay,
well, I'm pulling them two separate times, you know? It's like, we did a beat, we were very difficult, but now we just need to see and get a beat. Okay, let's start with who thinks what would be easiest to do in spite of obfuscation. Let's start with A. Who thinks A would be easiest? These. Okay, B, C, D. Okay. Okay. And who would, what people think would be hardest in spite of obfuscation? Who thinks A, B, C, D? Okay. So we seem to agree that A is easiest. And I think I would agree with that because the simplest way of doing this, assuming it consistently accesses those remote servers, is you just run it and see what request it makes to the OS, possibly in a VM or something. But that seems like least hampered by the sort of obfuscation techniques we've seen so far. And I think our second, and as for hardest, I think we had that, I think B is probably hardest because we actually need to figure out a potential input. I think C is easier than B, and the reason why is that we basically need to figure out how to flip a comparison. And the techniques we've shown so far have not been, they've been okay, but not excellent at hiding that existence of that comparison from us. And we can probably guess where it is based on context, and that would help. So I guess relevant to that, I guess I probably should have an extra slide on additional obfuscation sort of transformations. There's some notable transformations we probably should mention that are relevant to some of these. So other obfuscation transformations is adding a relevant code. So that's something you might do against, are they just gonna flip my password check? I'll just automatically add a relevant code and maybe checks that the irrelevant code still runs would be an example of a transformation. And also relevant to making the password more obscure, something we didn't see is adding a relevant additional conditions to if statements, etc. That's another thing that's a common obfuscation transformation to make it harder to figure out what code is doing. And since that code's, you know, extra code is irrelevant, like it's not, like obviously you can figure that out eventually, but you know, that takes time and makes Dihedra output and similar a lot less useful. So for accessing extra functionality, so you just flip the compare, basically, should be what works somewhere. But you need to figure out where that is, which is the techniques we've seen make a lot more difficult. Or you need to figure out what function is called and how, but they're excellent at hiding that from us. For determining whether the malware behaved differently based on time, it depends on how differently, but the simplest thing is you can run it at different times and see what request it makes of the system. If those are different, you've learned. Another thing you can look for is, well, none of the techniques we showed really obscured operations like printing or getting the time. Like, we know where those are. And if the malware gets the time, that's a pretty makes a guess that it will behave differently probably, without needing to do more analysis. Questions on my conclusions? Here. Okay, so let's get to other. Okay, so last time we mentioned that one thing for signatures that malware tried to obscure was like library calls. They would make good signatures. Malware would often need to look up a library function dynamically. You know, and they would often have code, you know, like this, where we had this problem that we had this get file attribute say name hard coded. Now we've seen one way of not hard coding that name, of having code that like breaks it out character by character. Another idea that's common in malware is that whenever we have to search for a name, we instead search for the hash of that name. And I'm showing this with library functions. Now here, this is library functions. But this can be also for like registry keys, file names of system files you want to infect. Anytime you're scanning a list of names for something, this is a strategy malware will often use to obscure those names. You know, just kind of a generic thing. You just store the hashes, you check if the hash matches. Now someone needs to figure out, you know, what file name, what registry key, what, you know, are you actually looking for? You know, they can't just read your code to find that out, kind of fundamentally. Like, they can probably do it because there's only so many possibilities realistically. Like, this is not a secure, like, encrypting it in a real way, but it's really, you know, makes it hard to determine for analysis, you know, things like, you know, what files does this infect if you're using this technique to identify the files, for example. And the other thing that that malware would often do is instead of writing character by character, we might have the string stored, you know, encrypted in some way, and then decrypt them. Where I'm using encrypted in quotes because, well, you know, I guess XORing by single character is an encryption algorithm, but it's not very good encryption where the key is right there, right alongside the encrypted data. You know, that's not really encryption. But it does make analysis more difficult. And this kind of encryption idea is kind of the most important thing that malware does, you know, the sort of main strategy we've seen to evade signature-based detection. So we're going to do a better version of the decryption idea, and we're going to, you know, have to deal primarily with the issue that, well, the decryption code is a good signature. We want to get rid of that eventually. And also we want to, like, encrypt more than just strings. So the first thing we might do is we're going to encrypt the data, the code. We're going to encrypt the actual code that does the malicious thing. So we'll have our machine code. We'll do some sort of decryption. It's not like really secure because the key is right here. But the idea is that if it's even half-baked reasonable encryption, then any signature-based detection on this stuff will be pretty useless as long as we randomize the key. And we're going to decrypt it, then jump to it. Also, we can mix this with compression to make our payload smaller if we want to do that. So as an example, here's a simple virus called Cascade, where what they did is they have this loop here where they just copy the location of the encrypted code into a register. This is 16-bit code, that's why we're using SI. we have store the length, and we have this loop where we XOR our remaining length with the value, the pointer and the remaining length with the value, just to obscure it from signatures. A little bit. And we can do a bit, and we can tweak this to make it, if we change the length or the location of the encrypted code, it's different every time, and if this is appending, different every time. So this is kind of maybe like the simplest way we can do it. So what So what should our strategy be for dealing with something that's using this decryptor strategy? A bunch of ideas that are all possible to implement. So the question is, which one is more or less practical? Minute to try to rank these. Okay, so let's start with, what the most practical is. Who think that's A, B, C, D? So we have agreement, I would agree. With what we've seen so far, C is the most practical. And our main topic next time is gonna be how malware tries to combat that issue. And basically the story is, they're gonna try to randomize this code. How about the least practical? Who thinks A is the least practical? B? C? D? So people think D is probably the least practical. I think I probably would agree. I think B is a close contender because B probably has a lot of false positives. And also the data from this type of decryption, and often the encryption being done is not very good encryption, so it probably also doesn't look actually very random to an entropy test. When it's not a good encryption algorithm, so it's not good at randomizing the data. So I think B and D are like our contenders there. Questions about our simple directory. So, yeah.
Is matching malware code in memory while it's running a viable strategy?
I think it's a thing you could do. So as we'll discuss later, there's typical modern systems don't have memory be writable and executable at the same time. So that does give us actually a pretty good opportunity as where to do the sort of switch between the two. And even if it was writable and executable, we could imagine, would it be too hard to imagine implementing a strategy where you pretend it's writable and executable, but under the hood it's really not executable, and when you try to execute it, you scan it first. So I think it's doable. I think it has a big performance impact, which is gonna impact its practicality, and you'd want to exempt some applications of which would be a real concern for having malware from it, like web browsers who write code for JavaScript all the time as machine code. But it's doable, yeah. With OS support. Okay, so our next topic, as I said, so next time is gonna be that we want to make the decryptor code not a signature. Though I note that even if the decryptor code's a signature, this allows us to change the malware and the and we don't have a signature that says this is Cascade that does A versus B if we're just checking on that signature. We've detected it, we haven't detected what it does. So the strategy we'll look at next time is this idea where basically we'll have a decryptor generator that will randomize the decryptor. We'll talk about what that looks like.